Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amy Willens, whose book is titled Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Amy Willens is the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now, I Feel Earthquakes More Often Than They Happen, and Martyrs Crossing. Amy Willens, for the past several years, has been writing letters from Haiti for The New Yorker, for The Nation.
The New York Times, The LA Times, op-ed pieces on Haiti. I've been going back and forth for about 30 years. I hate to admit that.
Before we go into the book, which is mostly about Haiti since the earthquake, which is now 3 years ago, I want to start by going into a little bit how you originally went to Haiti and what was your first impression 30 years ago?
Well, I went down because I was working for Time magazine, and that was a fairly sterile job to be doing. It was one of my early jobs in journalism, and I was just a writer, and at the time, Time separated reporters from writers. So reporters were in the field, and they would send you their cables as if you were in the CIA, and then you would write their cables up for the magazine. So I was a writer, you know, in the canyons of the Avenue of the Americas.
And how did you get that gig?
I left Newsday. You know, I was just one of the people who was around in New York writing at the time. So.
And they sent you down there?
No, not at all. I read The Comedians by Graham Greene, a great novel that's about the reign of Papa Doc Duvalier in Haiti, and about the Tonton Macoute, Papa Doc's secret police. And I was, like, fascinated by the Tonton Macoute. And then I spoke French, so I was reading the newspapers of the Haitian refugees who had fled from Papa Doc's regime and who had come to live in my neighborhood on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I read their papers, and suddenly I realized, oh, my God, the Duvaliers are going to fall. This is the end of the Duvaliers in Haiti, and I'm going to miss it. You know, even though they were evil, I was drawn to Haiti already, and I didn't want to miss this bit of history that I could see before it was over. So I took vacation from Time, and I rushed down to Haiti, and I got there 5 days before Baby Doc Duvalier fell, and I saw that, and then I was hooked forever. I mean, it was an incredible moment where you thought democracy was coming to Haiti. That's my first book.
And that was the rise of Aristide the first time, and then there was the second time.
Right.
Not too long ago, I interviewed Tom Reese about his book, The Black Count, which was about Alexandre Dumas, who came from Haiti. And that's when I learned that Haiti's independence, which came in 1804, was precipitated by the fact that the French Revolution wanted to do away with slavery. And, in fact, Napoleon came to power because the French planters wanted to get their slavery back.
That's an interesting way to interpret it. You'd have a lot of Haitians objecting to the idea that their revolution happened only because some French guy had the idea that the slaves should be liberated, because they would argue that the Haitian slaves had a very, very big idea that they should be liberated even before the rights of man and the French Revolution.
Well, there was already a rebellion in the hills at the time.
The rebellion was beginning. It didn't really take full force until 1791, so that is, as I calculated with my very bad mathematics, 2 years after the French Revolution. So word did filter down to the slaves that not only did they think they should be free, but some white guys from France thought they should be free. So that was a very important bolster for the slaves who are in revolt.
And then in 1804, they became free. But something you mentioned parenthetically in Farewell, Fred Voodoo, you mentioned that they gave reparations to France for, I guess, the land and the slaves sometime in the mid-1800s?
Well, what happened was, you know, it was a very premature revolution. It set the stage for the end of slavery everywhere, which was kind of becoming a movement anyway in Europe and elsewhere. But the United States still had slaves in 1804, as we will remember from our American history. And so the Haitian slaves got their liberty, took over their country, became the world's first black republic, and it was a shock to the world. For instance, Jamaica did not become its own free independent state until 1965, just as a reminder of how early this was. And the United States didn't recognize Haiti until 1867, 2 years after the Civil War had come to an end. And France did not want to recognize Haiti, of course, because it had destroyed its economy. It had lost it the Louisiana Purchase. It had done many, many bad things for the French. But they said, okay, we will recognize you. But you have to pass an indemnity, and the indemnity was for property lost in the revolution. Even though the Haitian slaves had won the revolution, the French had lost. That's not the way reparations usually go. And the Haitians agreed because they were basically at the mercy of Europe. It was a very steep reparation, and it was for property lost, as I said. The plantations, the sugar crops, and the Haitian slaves themselves. So they were paying, in essence, for their very bodies, their very own freedom.
I mention this now because this was the start of where we are today, that there's a direct link between that and where we are today.
Well, when you're a baby nation with an immature economy and you have to start paying millions, what were the equivalent of millions of dollars a year to the metropole, as France, Paris was called, you're stunted immediately from birth. And if people want to know why is Haiti like that, I think they can go right back to the indemnity that Haiti was forced to pay in the early days of the 1800s.
Moving on, we have a 19-year occupation by the United States. We have this ghastly dictator and his ghastly son, the Duvaliers. And then we have a kind of democracy that gets overthrown multiple times, and it brings us to today. What I found fascinating in your book, Amy Willens, is that there are no good guys there. The United States has been atrocious in its behavior toward Haiti. Most foreign countries have been atrocious, and they've created a climate which almost seems unsolvable.
Yes, in a way, it's like it's as if Haiti has had a lot of bad parents, like Haiti's parents got divorced early, and then they married abusive people, and everybody was bad, and they've twisted the country so that the country doesn't function either. It functions in the twisted world of the international friends of Haiti, the U.S., Canada, France. The U.S. occupation, I think historically, if you look at the U.S. occupation, which went from 1915 to 1934, there's no argument but that that occupation and the destruction it wrought in Haitian culture and politics led almost directly to the ascent of Papa Doc Duvalier, who came to power as a black nationalist in 1957. Now, he was far from a real liberationist, but he masqueraded as such, and that spoke to people after those years of occupation by the Americans.
And then after that, we have the post-Duvalier years culminating 3 years ago in an earthquake which demolished Port-au-Prince, the capital, and put millions, hundreds of thousands of people on the streets.
1.2 million.
1.2 million. And how many people died?
Well, that's up for dispute, but it's between, the best guesses are between 200,000 and 300,000 people, which is unimaginable. But it's funny that you say, you know, post Duvalier, Haiti culminating in the earthquake. That's such a Haitian way to think, as if the acts of man that are politics are sort of similar to the acts of nature that end up in an earthquake.
Let's talk a little about elements of the book. First of all, the title, Farewell Fred Voodoo. Fred Voodoo refers to how foreigners would view Haitians. Is that correct?
Well, it actually was a term used to me by British journalists when I first got to Haiti. And, you know, reporters are very harsh, nasty people. But I wasn't yet, but I was learning. And I would get back to the hotel terrace where we were all staying after the fall of Duvalier, and my friends would say to me, well, you know, did you talk to Fred Voodoo today? And I would go, like, what? What they meant was the Haitian man in the street, as if they were saying Joe Sixpack. So this was Haitian tailors and Haitian cab drivers and Haitian farmers, anyone you could imagine. And really, that's how the foreign press corps looked at Haitians in general. They were all sort of tarred with the brush of what these people considered superstition and mysterious African doings that voodoo seems to conjure up for the outsider.
Yet, in your book, you went to a voodoo ceremony, and there's a part of you going, you know, I don't think they necessarily believe this themselves.
Well, I think they believe something about it, the Haitians, definitely. And it may have been that particular voodoo ceremony because I asked to see it. It might not have been that good a one. I've been to many, many voodoo ceremonies, however, and I do think there is that aspect of it. And maybe it's only my white skepticism, you know, my white Jewish skepticism when encountering real belief. I just can't believe anyone believes it. So it's partly the observer in me that is that way. But it's partly that it is so much of a show that it feels like it must be staged.
Well, also, you had the Toutan Makuts, and they were virtually supernatural monsters. I mean, they were the police corps of Duvalier, but the horror of having them around would certainly propel someone, I guess, towards supernatural thought.
Yes, but of course voodoo predates everything.
Sure.
And voodoo is the real name for it, not voodoo. Voodoo, I use voodoo in the book because it's the way outsiders think about it. The book is mostly about outsiders and Haitians and how they view each other. But the Tonton Macoute is really interesting because that's a figure from Haitian folklore. Tonton Macoute, it means uncle. Bag. And this is, he's like an anti-Santa Claus. He makes a list, he checks it twice, he finds out who's naughty or nice, and then he goes and puts you in his bag and spirits you away in the middle of the night. So if you have a nursemaid, she's likely to say, watch out for Tonton Macoute. So that's who they called their secret police after.
And Duvalier used that in order to maintain power.
Exactly. He used that, and he used voodoo very much. He used it for his own political goals.
The earthquake happened, and you went down there, and the destruction you saw was pretty overwhelming. At the same time came the NGOs, the church groups, the Clintons, Sean Penn.
A veritable Noah's Ark of do-gooders.
What you say about the NGOs in particular is very, very harsh, though you're not exactly kind to the Clintons either.
You know, Bill Clinton, his motto for Haiti was build back better. He was the UN special envoy to Haiti before the earthquake. He has a special affection for Haiti, and I believe that's totally sincere. But, you know, they just came in droves. They didn't know what they were doing. The Global Initiative, the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. And they have a model that predates the earthquake, so that reconstruction for them was just simply doing, again, what they were already wanting to do before the earthquake. And in some cases, that meant building a garment factory in the north of Haiti where there are no earthquake victims whatsoever. Or in some cases it meant donating $2 million toward the construction of a luxury hotel in Port-au-Prince called the Royal Oasis. And many other littler projects than those that were not really earthquake reconstruction at all. And when you consider that there are 358,000 people in Port-au-Prince and its environs still in earthquake camps, living in the worst conditions that you would have to call an actual de facto human rights violation on the ground, you wonder why $2 million is going to a luxury hotel.
You made a comment in an op-ed piece for the LA Times that people harshly criticized your letter from Haiti that was in The Nation, which specifically discussed the Royal Oasis and this factory in the north. What were they so upset about? The Royal Oasis, the factory? Why were they so angry?
The factory itself was mad because it's a nice factory. I called it, in my blog actually, this is what they were so mad about, I called it the new style plantation. So, you know, these are a bunch of supposedly well-meaning South Koreans who have 22 garment factories around the world. The pot had been very much sweetened for them to get them to agree to come into post-quake Haiti. It's not exactly, you know, anyone's cup of tea who's running an international business. And the Clintons worked really hard on it, and the State Department worked really hard on it. And everyone was mad at me for, without having seen the factory, okay, I'm a blogger now too, not just a journalist, attacking it. They were all up in arms, and then they made me come down to see the factory itself, which I then did.
But on the other hand, in Farewell, Fred Vudu, when you talk about building the factory, because the factory wasn't built then,
right,
you know, what kept coming to my mind, and I think you sort of hinted at it, was a place like Foxconn.
Absolutely. Well, I write about this globalization of Haiti that has been really destructive for Haiti, and I'm not sure that there's any escape from the global market for any country, but especially, of course, a poor country like Haiti. And my concern was always that in Haiti, if you have the long view, you've just seen it before. So Duvalier, he moved all the poor out of the center of town. They were homeless and it wasn't good for tourism. And he moved them to a new shanty town called Cité Simone at the time, named after his wife. And then he had an industrial park built, and people came in from the outside, baseball companies, little, you know, maquiladora kind of thing. And it didn't really work. But the people from the shantytown worked in those factories, and then their children were born into the shantytown, and they worked in those factories, and then their children were born. So it never raises you out of poverty. And the people associated with the new factory up in Caracol, so I call it the Caracol factory, they understand that too. They understand very well that the garment industry does not raise anyone out of poverty, and have said so to me point blank. But what they say, and they're not wrong, is that Haiti needs an economic plan. But then no one is willing to include the government in any decisions. And also the Caracol factory, I just have to say it again, was built far away from earthquake land. So a lot of people were moved out of the camps and put into new sort of townships outside of Port-au-Prince, windblown, barren hills, and were promised that there would be factory work for them so they could make $3 a day. But no, instead they built the plant up in the north, where it's easier access to Miami. I don't know why.
Well, it also, as you say in the book, Farewell Fred Voodoo, what you say is that if they're out of the way, there's less chance of protesting
right. The
conditions
we
as
won't,
well.
We won't see them. So the foreign press won't see them. And believe me, I had to go a long way to see this because I refused to fly. I wanted to be on the ground and see what was happening on the ground and how long it really takes to get to the place.
7 hours, you said, right?
Yeah, 7 to 9 hours, and then you have to get out to the place itself. It makes any abuses that might happen, and this firm has been known to not treat its workers entirely fairly. It makes those that much harder to protest and to see. And so, you know, we're not going to know a lot about it.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Willens, whose book is titled Farewell Fred Voodoo. There's also the issue of bringing in these gold miners, which you talk about in the book and in the article in The Nation. There's no such thing as a good mining company.
No. I love that one of the a former mining official in Haiti, he was fired basically for not making the road clear for the mining interests to come into Haiti. And he said, look, if the mining companies are honest and if Haiti has a good government, this could be really fantastic for Haiti. And I know, hearing that he's speaking tongue-in-cheek because Haiti doesn't have a good government and the mining companies are not honest usually. As far as I understand it now, some 15% of the Haitian national territory has been ceded to these mining interests for exploration, and Haiti has a huge deposit of gold, silver, and copper under the land.
And none of it will wind up going to the Haitians.
Well, the in dispute was a 50% tax that this guy said was part of Haitian law. Haiti has to get 50% of the profits, but that was overturned by a memo of understanding that he refused to sign.
I was looking at Machiko Kakutani's review in the New York Times, and I noticed that she was a little bit critical of your criticisms, which, given what NGOs and foreign countries have done to Haiti, it seemed to me that she was a little bit harsh on you.
She just doesn't know. She just hasn't read her own newspaper.
There is a quote that she gives. It's a great quote. Haiti is the perfect example of what would happen if Ronald Reagan's dream of a privatized state should become a reality. That's exactly what Indians have said about India.
See, that's what was so funny about that review. I mean, half of the review was very nice, and half was like, she's way too harsh on NGOs. And then she would quote these things. All my friends who know Haiti just would read it to me laughing because everything she quoted, everyone absolutely believes who knows about Haiti. And then she thought I was being sarcastic or something. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, of course, Ronald Reagan. I always would walk through the streets of Haiti and think, privatized sanitation, no sanitation is taken away. Privatized schools, they don't teach anything in the schools, but it costs money. Privatized electricity, everything is privatized there, and nothing works because no one really cares.
Most people can't afford it anyway.
Right, exactly. In fact, the electricity is nationalized, largely nationalized, and it's stolen. So it's become privatized in effect. People put up little wires and steal the electricity from the poles.
I kind of like the fact that you got caught in an elevator in that hotel because the electricity went out.
It was so perfect. So this is the new luxury so-called hotel. I mean, if you Americans saw it, you would not think. It would not leap to your mind that this is a luxury hotel, but it does have 5 supposedly fancy restaurants, all of which were closed on the day after its inauguration. It has 9 stories. It has a presidential suite. It has a shopping mall. It has a planned infinity pool for the roof. So we get in the elevator. We want to go see the presidential suite on the 9th floor, right? And the minute I hit 9, the cabin goes dark. And my friend is standing there saying, in a month, when they really open, they're going to find our bodies in the corner, and they're going to say, who the heck are these people?
I also love that when you said, how earthquake-proof Is this hotel the answer was, we'll see.
But that was the new university. We'll see when there's an earthquake.
Which is another place. That's up north as well,
that's
right?
That's up right near the factory. Yeah, they're trying to, you know, get some kind of critical mass. But the university, again, it's like a Potemkin village right now anyway. There are students but no teachers.
And nobody really wants to handle the real issue, which is Port-au-Prince. Is that correct?
Right. Well, that's how I feel. I mean, going up north, I saw the new factory, which is very world-class right now. It may not continue to be so. The new university, which is a gorgeous building with some students in it and, you know, 2,000 students and about 50 teachers so far. What else is there up there? Oh, and then the mining. So right. All this stuff working together. And then there's a lot of possible tourist destinations there, like the Citadel and the Palace of Henri Christophe Sanssouci. So it could have something going, but it's like they put all this money that was for the earthquake into this place not near the earthquake, while Port-au-Prince has been tossed into the wastebasket of history.
Amy Willens, many of the NGOs have now left.
And they're pulling up stakes, sure, because they, you know, it's hard and there's no longer the kind of fundraising possibility that you can do anymore with Haiti.
And then there's the cholera epidemic, which came about because UN people came from Nepal and brought it with them.
Nepalese soldiers in the MINUSTA, it's called, the UN mission for the stabilization of Haiti. And there were new troops who came in after the earthquake, and they carry a type of cholera. They're not sick. So they don't even know they carry it, right? And they come in, and the sanitation from their barracks was not done properly. And so waste from the barracks went into the Haitian water system, and immediately Haitians started getting very sick and dying. About 8,000 people have died, and some, like, 635,000 people have gotten ill.
Is it getting better?
Well, what happens with cholera is it comes in seasons. So when the rainy season comes, and then the water is more diffuse, I think, then more people get it. So it gets better every year and then it comes back again. There are a lot of clinics dealing with it. You have to be, basically, it's a very survivable thing if you have access to rehydration salts and water, clean water. 42% of Haitians do not have access to clean water. So it's a big problem. But if you can get to a cholera clinic, of which now there are many around the country, you can survive it. But you have to get there. And when you have cholera, you don't realize it at first, and then by the time you can realize it, you're almost demented with dehydration. It takes 2 days to die.
Coming up are legislative elections, but they keep getting pushed back. So what is the status of the kleptocracy, the ruling class, right now?
Well, you know, I always say that Haitian government and Haitian politicians, there are definitely many good people in there, in the mix. Even under the Duvaliers, there were some people who were trying to do their best. But now more so. But it's still, it's almost, and I write about this in my book, it's almost as if the government is a machine that was created to take money away, that that's the way it functions, that that's its role there, is to be corrupt. So it just gets paid off not to do its job so that others, exploiters and users, can come in and do what they want in Haiti. So you pay off an official, and there, now you're free to do what you want.
As I was reading your book, it occurred to me that nothing seemed to be working. We can't leave them alone because they have no money. If we interfere, we're interfering. If we interfere and give them money, then there's dependence. And on top of that, there's a corrupt aristocracy, if you want to call it that, and a corrupt government at the same time. What happens? Where do you go? What do you do?
Well, you know, you say we have to interfere, they have no money. This is not entirely true. There is money coming into Haiti, and that money is in remittances from Haitians who've left the country. The real reason you see Haiti continuing on and on and on and on, in spite of all the environmental despoliation, in spite of huge population pressure, etc., is because basically Haitians who've managed to get out are feeding the country. So there's that. So I don't think, you know, without us there, there would be a huge famine. In fact, without us there, maybe they would be able to feed themselves again, because it was our interference, and I don't just mean the U.S., although largely it was American, our interference in their economy that caused them to stop being able to feed themselves. Someone was talking to me yesterday in Seattle about a section of the country called the Grand Anse, and in the Grand Anse, when she was there, it was kind of a country of its own. There was no road that really got there. It was so rutted you could hardly get out there. And they just lived on their own, like an African village up in the mountains. And they worked with each other. You know, of course, my friend was a bit of a leftist, so she's describing perhaps a utopia that didn't really exist. But I remember this from old Haiti, that villages worked together, they got along, they raised rice, they had their little gardens where they got protein out of the beans, and they had each their little pig, which the Americans eradicated at a certain point because they feared it might spread swine flu to American pigs. You know, I mean, I don't want to be part of the Republican discourse that says we shouldn't be giving foreign aid, because that seems to me mean and cruel. But on the other hand, sometimes I think maybe Haiti would be better off left to its own devices, because it's such an incredible place and it could do so much good. But then I think about Duvalier and I think, well, maybe that's what would happen. So, you know, I'm no good. I can't tell you what to do, Haiti.
The U.S. was complicit in the removal of Aristide twice.
Twice, under Baby Bush and under Papa Bush, as I like to call them. So in 1991, Aristide, who was the first freely and fairly elected president of Haiti, was removed in a coup d'etat by the army and the Haitian elite and possibly the American government. Then he was reinstated by President Clinton in 1994. And then he ran for president again later, and he was ousted in 2004 under Baby Bush.
I kept thinking, and maybe this is wrong, but I kept thinking that Aristide in his second incarnation, when he more or less bent over backwards for the elites in order to stay in power, I kept thinking maybe that's what Obama's doing in this country. Does that make some kind of sense?
Well, it makes sense. I mean, maybe it's true. Yeah, it makes a little bit of sense. The elites in both countries just both so against these two characters. But Aristide was very different from Obama. Obama is, at heart, a moderate. And Aristide is, at heart, kind of a populist orator. You know, a great figure for change, but maybe not such a great figure for running a country. I think Obama's very different from that.
Amy Willence, two people come out ahead in Farewell Fred Voodoo, and one of them is not Amy Willence. You're pretty hard on yourself.
I have to be.
And why are you there, and why is
and
a journalist there?
What am I doing?
Yeah. But the two people who come out ahead, one is Dr. Megan Coffey. Have you spoken to her since the book came out?
Yeah. She's not mad at me.
Well, she comes out very well. She's just there to help people.
I cite this person as an example of how you can work in a positive way for Haitians. But, of course, I also say in the book, and I really believe this, that the people who have it easiest in Haiti when they're trying to help are doctors. Because if you're building a house for a Haitian, they could like not like part of it, or it could be made of shoddy materials, or it could fall down in a storm. You don't know, really. You can have an idea, but you don't know. But if you're a doctor, you can give someone a shot of antibiotics, and tomorrow, after 7 years of being sick, they feel a lot better. So you can have a real visible effect. So that already, Megan is ahead of the game. She's a tuberculosis doctor, an infectious diseases specialist. And she started a TB ward in the general hospital in Port-au-Prince where there had not been one, because the hospital felt its sanitary conditions were not such that it could protect the other patients against this terrible disease. So they had outpatients instead. But Megan set up a TB ward right after the earthquake, and now she's kept it going. Now it's part of the institution. It's really very exciting. She deals with Haiti by learning from Haitians. And she has learned a tremendous amount. I mean, I've watched her now for 3 years when she knew nothing. Of course, she's kind of a little genius, too. She's like 36 years old, and she's just terribly smart and very doctory. I mean, it's not like she's an eccentric, erratic, you know, lady. She's a doctor. But she gets things very fast. She lives very cheaply. She never puts on airs. She travels in Haitian public transportation. And she speaks Creole, even though she can't speak Creole. And her patients laugh at her, and they join in because her Creole isn't so great. And she just has all these ways for getting things to work.
And what do the Haitians think about her out of her presence? Do they say anything?
Oh, they love her. They just think she's funny. She's like their kind of stern older sister who can always get them out of a jam.
You did not run into Paul Farmer, though.
Yeah, I ran into Paul Farmer.
And what's your view of him?
Well, see, there's another genius. Why are all these doctors so geniusy? you know, he's an institution in Haiti now. He started Partners in Health, and now the Haitian branch of that is called Zami La Santé, which means Friends of Health. And it's a giant nationwide institution with many clinics and many, many Haitian workers. It was one of the few institutions, you could call it an outside institution, but it's almost Haitian. But when the earthquake happened, it was one of the few institutions ready to cope with having money to spend, because it was diffuse and it was Haitian and it was big on the ground. The Red Cross had something like 13 people in Haiti when the earthquake struck, and Paul Farmer had like 340 or something like that. So it's a very different kind of institution. It, too, has learned about Haiti by studying from Haitians and by incorporating the Haitian government, as difficult as that can be.
Around the time of the earthquake, I interviewed Tracy Kidder, and he said, Partners in Health, they're the ones to give money to.
Well, now I say Partners in Health, or you can give to Megan, because she has a teeny little fundraising operation. So, and I know that with her, like, she looks for a computer for a particular patient, and then you give her the money, and then the patient gets the computer. And so it's a lovely thing. You know, if you like that kind of one-on-one thing, I think it's fantastic.
And people could find out on Megan Coffee.
They can go to Megan Coffee, or her institution, her little fundraising thing is called TIKAY, T-I-K-A-Y, Haiti, H-A-I-T-I, all it's one word, .org.
The other person, you spent most of the book, it's kind of this strange search through the book for Sean Penn, who you do find. And it's astonishing that, in your view at least, Penn comes out ahead. There was recently apparently an interview with someone told me about it on Fresh Air, who made the same complaint about Penn that you make about NGOs, which is he didn't know what he was doing.
He did not know what he was doing. That's definitely true.
But he's come out ahead.
Well, he didn't know what he was doing, but he wasn't arrogant. I mean, he made some big mistakes, definitely made some big mistakes at the beginning that he freely acknowledges, which is already a step in the right direction. And I may be suffering a little from Hollywoodism. So I live in Hollywood, and I know how not so smart actors can be. So he rises above that. So maybe I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt just because he seems so different from all the other people I know in the business. But he had a special thing going for him in Haiti. He didn't know what he was doing, and he energetically went about not knowing what he was doing, and he was Sean Penn. So when he didn't know what he was doing, he could get a lot of people together to help him figure out what to do. And he did do that, and sometimes he made mistakes because he got the wrong people to advise him. But then he went on and he did a lot of good things, and he depopulated his camp, and that's still ongoing. He's doing it gradually as he works to create housing for them so that it's an integrated thing. The depopulation of one of the biggest camps after the earthquake was his camp. I mean, I don't know if you can call it his, but he was really running all the services there. And this was another mistake. Because he's Sean Penn, all the best people wanted to work with him. Fabulous services, fabulous clinics, good little schools, you know, a little orphanage on site. So everyone wanted to move to his camp. I mean, you would practically leave your house and move to his camp at that point before the rainy season began. So that was a mistake, too. To have such good stuff was a mistake. So you see how Haiti is very confounding, and you can understand why people don't understand it. But at least Sean Penn was out there among it. He was in the camp every day. You know, he wasn't like these outsiders with huge organizations who come in. They live in gated communities. They keep themselves in their fancy cars, and they never really get out among the Haitians. And he's still there. He has staying power, and I don't think he'll leave. He might leave eventually, but I don't think so.
A friend of mine who worked with him on the movie Milk said that the intensity that he brought to gay rights and Milk, that intensity translates.
And that's what he's doing in Haiti. That's exactly right. It's a personality thing, I think, and it's his fame. His fame is extremely useful to him.
Amy Willents, you said in an interview with Guernica magazine, Haiti is my muse. What did you mean by that?
Well, a colleague of mine recently wrote to me. She gave me what I consider to be a backhanded compliment, because I've written two books about Haiti, one book about California, and one novel about the Middle East. And she said that she had started Farewell Fred Voodoo, and I quote virtually, and something happens to your writing when you write about Haiti. So I wrote back to her. I said, oh, something happens to my writing when I write about Haiti, but not the rest of the time, is what you're trying to say. But, in fact, I think she's right. I mean, Haiti is my muse. It was my first story. It was my first book. It came to me like fate. That's what I feel, really. I think it's because of expertise, even though I freely admit to huge gaps in my understanding and knowledge, but because of my long-time relationship with it now. It comes to me in an easy, pleasurable way, as if I were possessed by it, if I can use that expression.
When I began going to Hawaii to visit, it took me over in the same way, so
right.
I guess I understand
it
that.
It comes down into you like the gods of voodoo.
One thing that's important, and I think it's something I'd like you to go into a little bit more here, which is what people don't get is they don't understand Haiti on its own terms. How does one understand a place like Haiti on its own terms?
It's hard to do if you don't go there. So I think you have to be there. I hate to lapse into these, like, sort of Victorian things, but to feel the spirit of the place, you have to be there, right? I think one way to understand it on its own terms, and this is asking a lot of a casual observer, of course, is to learn the language. And the language is a path into the heart of Haiti, definitely, because you feel all the history of it. It's a very new language. It only started with slavery in Haiti, so it's only about 400 years old. And it's beautiful to understand the Africanness of it, the English of it. To say Happy New Year in Haitian Creole now, you say A Pied Nouye, because the Marines used to shout Happy New Year to the Haitians from their trucks as they drove through town on January 1st, and the Haitians heard it as A Pied Nouye, which actually means we're walking barefoot. But that's how they say it.
Creole itself, what's the relationship of that to English or French? Or is it just a combination and a mix of everything?
I'm a layperson. I don't understand it linguistically.
Right.
But it's like French with an African grammar, a pared-down French, very efficient language. And it has certain aspects of it that are kind of hidden. It's less particular. Instead of saying he, she, or it, you have one word, li. So when the master hears you talking about someone, he has no idea. Are you talking about an it? Are you talking about your sister? Are you talking about your son? He can't know. And I'm sure that that is how that arose.
So in a sense, there are hidden nooks and crannies for protection.
For protection in the old days and still today, I think. There are ways of hiding from the outside world.
Speaking of Haitian culture, is there a Haitian cuisine?
Oh, yeah. So good. I love it. Although my son, who spent some time there, says all they do is cook goat over and over. I think it was the same goat, Mom.
So what is it similar to French?
It has a lot of French notes in it. You know, it's Creole. It's a little bit like Louisiana food. One thing that they make that I love so much is they take pork and then they must fry it for a half a century. And it's like this hard little thing. And then they serve it. And it's very tasty pork, and then they serve it with really spicy, like a coleslaw called piclis. I guess that's the Marines' influence, too, piclis. And it is just so good. And many other things.
The Haitian people, who you view in a very special light, they're not Fred Voodoo to you.
No.
They're just extraordinary human beings.
Well, there are many, many different ones. And they're extraordinary, and they can be extraordinarily lovely, but they can also be extraordinarily tough, very tough. So I can't really put them into any one box. I mean, I wish I could say they were a darling, sweet, pastoral people. But that would be a lie, my friends.
But that's also true of any people
anywhere.
Of
course, and that's how they should be viewed, as like any people anywhere, except they are more resilient. But the reason they're resilient is the reason any humans would be resilient. I think often of Jews during the Holocaust and the long marches, and if you read Elie Wiesel's descriptions of what the Jews went through during the Holocaust, I think that the Haitians are in a continual Holocaust, a situation of that kind of tension and pressure and deprivation, and they rise to it as many of my people did rise to that situation. It's just human. And when I hear resilience, I think it means, okay, it's okay to beat them down a little more, and that's not what one should assume.
It's that they are able to survive
right.
And prosper as well as they could.
Right.
Amy Wilentz, I understand you're now working on a novel.
That's true. I hope. I was working on it, indeed, before the earthquake struck. And then the earthquake came, and I said, I just have to go back to Haiti. I have to do it. I didn't even plan a book at all, but I thought, I better go. I can't not go. That would be really wrong, irresponsible.
How much of the book comes from the letters that were published elsewhere? How much is original?
There are a couple of things. There are like maybe 10 pages of the whole book was kind of changed stuff of stuff I published after the earthquake.
And you knew that when you were going down, you were going to work on this book then?
Not when I went down at first, but then I was talking to a friend. I was sitting in a nice restaurant in Port-au-Prince up the hill, like a white person or a rich person, and we were having lunch, and I was just talking, and she was talking, and I was thinking, you know, every time I come to Haiti, my brain starts working on overkill, overtime. There's so much to think about here. I better write another book.
And it's pretty obvious from reading the end of the book that you said you were done, and yet at the same time, suddenly we see in The Nation yet another letter from Haiti, so it can't stop.
Yeah, people think farewell Fred Voodoo means I'm leaving. But no, it just means let's not think about Fred Voodoo anymore. Let's not call him that. Let's not have that be the thing we think of when we think of Haiti, but something new. So goodbye to Fred Voodoo.
When I finished the book, I was pretty depressed because it seemed to me that you were talking about no way out. And yet I wonder in our discussion now, maybe there is a way out. Maybe things aren't hopeless.
I refuse hopelessness. It is not, you know, it's not useful. It's so easy for people to be hopeless. Look, man's condition is hopeless in the first place, right? But I don't think you can be hopeless because then you can't keep trying to think of a way out. And you have to be optimistic. My natural tendency as a person brought up in my culture is to be basically pessimistic, but I have to be optimistic about Haiti. It's what I learned from my friends in the Liberation Church. You got to keep working.
Do you think it would be okay for recommend people to visit Haiti as tourists?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I know that I think there's a security warning right now from the U.S. government, but most everyone who's had a problem recently has been Haitian or Haitian American. So, of course, to my Haitian American friends, I say you have to be careful, super careful. But I really haven't felt scared. I had one moment in this camp that I went to before I went up to the Royal Oasis Hotel, and it was just me, really. Nothing was happening, but I thought, what if someone had a gun suddenly here in this situation? It was too tight, too crowded. Maybe it was just my claustrophobia. But I haven't been scared. There have been kidnappings, but not many of outsiders. I mean, I hate to say that that's not a problem. Of course it's a problem. Haitians shouldn't be kidnapped either. But if you're thinking of going down, then there are amazing things to see, and there are beautiful beaches in the north. But you have to be willing to see what's there. I mean, there's poverty. You're not going to have a vacation like in Puerto Rico.
Finally, you make mention that the best joke about Haiti and America is there are no coup d'etats in Washington because there's no American embassy there.
Isn't that nice? Why are there no coups in Washington? Because there's no U.S. embassy.
You've been listening to an interview with Amy Willents, whose book is titled Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.